This is a podcast about answering one question. Are you on a journey that matters enough to you? To answer this question, you're going to need to dive right into your middles. I'm obsessed with middles. I've come to think that middles deserve another look. To ensure that you are on a journey that matters enough to you, buckle into that middle seat and let's go on this adventure together. Hashtag welcome aboard. Welcome, friends, to today's podcast. We have a treat in store for you. It is my honor to have on our show today Brian Morgan. Brian was the managing editor of New York City's premier planning and engineering company for over 16 years, AKRF. The projects that firm worked on included the World Trade Center, Moynihan Station, and almost all of the major projects that reshaped New York City over the last generation. Brian's structure for teaching writing and critical thinking at that firm, which improved the product, saved millions of dollars in effort, and was taught to every employee and department, is now the core product of his own company, Think Deeply, Write Clearly. In his first year in business, his clients include major government departments and multi-billion dollar corporations. He also teaches marketing through thoughtful writing to companies of any size, including solopreneurs. Brian received his Bachelor's of Arts from the New School and his Master's of Fine Arts at St. Joseph's College. Overall, Brian is an incredible writer, teacher, and one of my favorite critical thinkers out there. So it is an honor to have him on the show. And one piece of advice I would offer to anyone listening to this episode is to press pause as often as you'd like. Brian is going to drop so many transformative concepts in this one episode that I highly encourage you to do some thinking, do some writing, text, call, have some conversations just around the concepts that Brian is going to discuss in our conversation together. It's transformative, one of the many reasons why we're pleased to have Brian on the show. Brian, so glad to have you here. We're just going to jump right in. I know we've talked at length on a lot of this, a lot of these topics, and I'll just start with that first question. When you hear the question, are you on a journey that matters enough to you? What does it mean to you?
What's interesting now is I'm sitting here and I'm not staring at my notes from the other day, and now I'm petrified that I'm going to like answer it differently than I answered it the other day. Okay.
Listen, it doesn't have to be scripted. That's dangerous.
All right. No, I think that is dangerous. Okay. I'm going to answer it as I'm feeling right now and just alleviate this concern that I might have had. Okay. So I'm sorry. So would you ask your question again? Because I got very concerned there for a second and then I got all caught up in my head. Okay.
All right. Yeah. So a lot of the listeners in this community, they're asking themselves, am I on a journey that matters enough to me? So that's kind of the focus of Mala in the Middle. So I'm always curious to guess, when they hear that question, what does it mean to them?
Well, I think if I was to be really honest about the answer to that question, I would say for how I would frame matters to me changed at several different times in my life, number one. But I don't know that I was on a journey that really mattered to me until recently. If I can get into that for a second, I think what that means to me is the journey that I thought mattered to me when I was younger was probably a journey of my own self-indulgence and my ego and things. And there's all sorts of psychological babble as to why that might be. You know, I didn't get all of my parents and things, but
so self-indulgence, ego driven. I mean, give us like kind of an age spectrum.
So I think certainly when I was in high school, I would have said I was on a journey that matters to me, but I think all that was really happening in high school really was that I was starting to write plays and I was starting to be recognized. And then I would say, oh, like writing plays matters to me, but that's not true. But being noticed mattered to me, you know, and I think you'd go so far. When I first came to New York, I was here to be an actor because I didn't know another avenue at that time to find sort of meaningful connection. And it was also an ego-driven, decision, right? And so, well, did I really love theater? I did, and I do. Um, but But am I more rewarding and rewarded now by the world than I was when I was on stage? Absolutely. And so all the time I think that I was making decisions pretending to be value driven by something that I was doing. I was going to be an actor. I was going to be a manager. I was going to be a businessman. I was going to be these other things. But in reality, I was looking for a reflection from the world onto my ego. And I think I only really understood that I didn't have a meaningful spot in the world until I actually learned that and had to let it go. And I don't know, Mala, honestly, I think that journey is probably still ongoing, but I don't think I even really had a true understanding of that journey until maybe the last 5 years or so.
Makes perfect sense. We talk a lot about the extrinsic rewards on our journey and the intrinsic rewards on our journey. And I think our ego smiles big with extrinsic rewards. Those are the headlines. Those are the trophies. So if you were an actor and you won an Academy Award, that's a good ego boost. Probably one of the best, right? But it's kind of, you're saying the last 5 years, you're going, wait a minute, who's determining the reward? And what's the value? Who determines the value of a reward? If it's not me, who is it?
I understand exactly where you are on this. And if you don't mind me going a little bit deeper into it. So I grew up personally, I don't know how you did, Mala, but I grew up in an academic family. And I wouldn't really wish that on anybody. I think there's probably liabilities and assets to all kinds of families, right? But a family has currency, right? And so it's going to create currency. And so if your family is full of sports people, then the currency is going to be whether or not you're an athlete or whether you performed well or whatever.
And if one of my family currencies,
yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And if your family's academic. But here's what I think the problem is with the academics, and I say this as somebody who teaches college. I think this is one of the things.
That AKA yourself.
Yeah. Here's the problem with academics. I think we far too often believe that. I think, if you don't mind me swearing, I think most human beings don't know what the f- they're doing throughout their whole lives. And academics pretend that they do. And so, but the academic doesn't either, right? I mean, let's be honest about that. The academic doesn't know what they're doing either, but they have to pretend because they teach, because they write books, they have to. And so the academic really walks into a room as ignorant as anybody else. And we spoke about this the other day. The human being is 13 billion, like the modern human being is 13 billion years out of context. Like, we're going to be ignorant before we have any kind of understanding of where we are. And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know why we run from that, but there's nothing wrong with that. But the academic is going to walk into a room as ignorant as anybody and then immediately ask, does everybody in this room think I'm smart? And so it sets us up. Where we're almost sitting on a light switch. And it's like in a room in which I'm respected, I'm smart, and I have value. And so I almost look for dumb people. Like my father and mother hated watching stupid sitcoms, but they loved watching stupid sitcoms, because I think what stupid sitcoms meant to them was that the world was stupid and they were smart. If the world thought that this stuff was funny, and they knew better, then they must be smart. I think they looked at it.
They were superior.
They were superior, exactly. Mm-hmm. So they looked at it as, oh, good, I'm glad that people make bad political decisions. I'm bad. I'm glad that people watch stupid TV. I'm glad they're right, because it proves how smart I am. So they weren't proud or even understood what it meant to be intelligent or what it meant, because I think intelligence and wisdom in particular requires a certain amount of acknowledgement of ignorance. And so I think that we learned this behavior of how the world looks, and if you can judge it, you're better.
Yep. I'm going to back up really quick to acknowledgement of ignorance is required both for a high level of intelligence and a high level of wisdom. But you're saying that's a baseline to achieve either one of those.
Yes, yep. I totally believe. And forgive me if we get political here for a second. I will never vote for a person who has the answers. And the problem in our politics is that we think that we're hiring somebody for their issues. Bullshit. We're not. We're hiring somebody for their approach to the issues. And so I would much rather hire somebody who I think has a great approach to something, and I don't always agree with their outcomes, because I trust that they're going to be thoughtful in how, like, government and decision makers, we have to be responsive. We don't know what the next crisis is. And so we have to be able to react in a thoughtful, meaningful way with a process of thinking. But if you go in and say the answer is this before I know all the information, the answer is this, I reject anybody as intelligent as a person who knows the answer to a question before they've heard it. It doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to go back to that question. Are you on a journey that matters enough to you, and the extrinsic rewards that our ego absolutely loves? And that's not a bad thing. It's really human. And then the intrinsic piece, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but you're saying perhaps if I'm on a journey that matters enough to me, I'm evaluating the role my ego plays in every decision I make. And for your journey, you said, okay, well, my teens, my 20s, maybe even my 30s, I didn't quite understand that maybe the ego was a real thing, A, B, and that it was on loudspeaker, or that had a really strong voice some point, right?
No, it makes perfect sense. And if any of your listeners are fans of the book, The Power of Now, the Eckhart Tolle book, you know, he talks about this pretty specifically, maybe in pretty stark terms, almost the way that you're describing it.
He sure does.
And so I appreciate your point of view on it. I really have come to believe that if we are not in control of our egos, and there's nothing wrong with the ego, by the way. I mean, to be perfectly clear,
no, it's a thing.
It's a real necessary thing, right? But if we're not in control of that thing, then it's going to grab control of us pretty hard and pretty fast.
Who's running what?
Yes.
So let's talk about decisions, because I loved the distinction you gave me on decisions and journeys, because your journey is a fascinating one. So I want to learn more about it. And maybe we can do this through decisions. You tell me. We had talked about the distinction between this kind of value, good value relationship driven decision versus a transactional decision. And if you want to walk us through some of your journey with that distinction, cool. If you don't, we can just describe the distinction and then move to your journey.
Well, I mean, my journey has ended up running a business.
And quite a successful one at that.
I appreciate you saying that. That's kind mm-hmm. of me. And strangely, one of the things that my business is teaching its clients, one of the reasons that people hire us, is because our marketing works. Right. And I fell into that. That was not something I planned to do. I planned to really just teach writing in corporations. But because my marketing of that worked so well, people started to say, well, can you teach me to market the way that you do? And it works. And
you would have never guessed that.
Yeah.
Ever. And neither would have your academic parents.
No, ever. Ever. No.
I was the communications marketing major, not you. Okay, and, go on.
And so what ended up happening was that we had to sort of look and say, well, what were we doing that was first of all working well for us? We've been very lucky with the clients that we've gotten. But so what was working for us? But when other people want to learn it, what was happening? And what you begin to realize is that so much of the world, and not just our business world, but it's obvious in business, but it's in our politics and it's in our business and it's in our employee relationships, even in some of our friendships, are based on transactions. And so I'm going to give you something of value. I'm going to manipulate you into I'm going to manipulate into buying my thing. And if I'm very good at manipulating you into buying my thing, I can take, you know, my price point, $5,000. And if it only costs me $1,000 relatively quickly to get you on the phone, and I can get $5,000 on the other side of that, I made a 400% return. Do that five times a day and you're quite wealthy.
I won.
Right. And so pretty good, right? And so people say, well, these transactions work. You can become quite rich. Well, you can, except I'm looking back over the transactions that I've made like that. Very, very few of them are people that I trust. And so it's like, well, how, so what were we doing that people were starting to say, you know, and I, you don't have to pitch me. You don't have to sell me. I already know who you are. I'm ready to buy today. This is the first phone call. Just, I need to know your prices and your system and how does it work? Right.
So
and
very so, clear need. I have a clear need.
Right.
I have a clear idea of what I'm buying or yes. thinking I'm buying.
And I've already decided you're the person to give it. And so we had built a relationship through the marketing that I didn't know we were building, right? And so because we had built that relationship through the marketing over time, all of a sudden we weren't in transactions. We were also in 2 months later, hey, I came across somebody who I think would be great for you. Can I get on a call with you? And it get 2 years, 2 months later, I know this isn't your thing, but I'm wondering if you could talk me through this issue I'm having, whatever it is. And so there's a vast difference in helping people with their lives and sort of showing value in a life and showing value in a moment. And I think that we have really misunderstood that if we overcompensate value in the moment, we don't necessarily improve each other's lives all that much.
Why do we hang out in the moments, Brian? Because we want it now? Because we're anxious?
I do. I think it's ego.
The outcome? What drives that?
Yeah, I do wholly think it's ego. I'm interested in your own thoughts on that. I know that you've probably done some thinking about this too, but I do think it's ego. I think we're worried that I'll say this, the greatest power in the world is being able to know that whatever happens, you can handle. And so if you get homeless, you can handle it. If you can't eat, you can handle it. If you get divorced, you can handle it. Like whatever happens, you can handle. That's the greatest
power. So the greatest power in the world is knowing that whatever happens, XYZ 127, right? You can handle it.
And I think
that's the power.
That's power, except I think we're so afraid of what might happen that when somebody's on the phone and we can make $5,000, we're like, I just better get this sale because it's going to protect me from homelessness. It's going to be, and it doesn't, of course. Like none of the things that we think protects us from life actually protect us from life.
None of the things we think protect us actually protect us.
Right.
Okay. So that goes back to the intrinsic reward for the journey and really for middles, which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But getting clear on the decision distinction is I can make a decision one of two ways. Number one is I need something. I need it sooner rather than later, often. And you're calling that, actually, I know we talked about that this occurs more as a child. And then as we mature, another outlet opens up, which is what you're saying about Mollet's trust. So I might not close the deal in conversation 1, 2, 4, or 7, but I may close it in conversation 15 and it never goes away. It's kind of an endless or bottomless reward. So even if it's not their business again, they've passed it on to somebody else who've called us and said, hey, John called me. He says, you're the best, right? So let's talk about your journey a bit. Brian, you know, in the intro, you know, I told the audience knows what you do and what you've done. When did you know that you were not on a journey that mattered enough to you? And please note that the word enough is really important here. It doesn't mean that one piece or pieces or the entirety of your journey hasn't mattered. It's just that at one point you realized this doesn't matter enough. Talk to us about that.
Mm-hmm. I think there's probably two spots in my life where I've had definite middles, to use your words. One was recent, so we'll start there. And then one was when I was younger and a little more religious. But the recent one was I was the managing editor of New York's probably premier environmental planning firm for 16 years. And it was a nice thing to be able to say and to do and to whatnot. But what was really happening during those 16 years is I was learning how to write. At first, I was writing books. And then I would eventually learn how to teach writing. And that ends up being where I am now.
Did you always enjoy writing, Brian?
I did.
In school, undergrad, graduate?
I was the kid who was 10 years old and writing novels at 2 a.m. on my mom's computer. And okay. She's getting out of
this. So writing is...
Yeah. I was that kid.
Got it.
And I would later understand, if you don't mind me going here for a second, I would later understand that language is the end product of thinking, and it's also the tool through which we think.
Language is the end product of thinking and the tool through which we think.
And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's true. So when we think words. Now, kids recognize feelings, and in a strange way, I think, recognize truth more than we do, because they're sort of connected more fully to the world. But the minute the human being's brain is literally expanded when we created language, and if we were going to talk about how did the human being become dominant in the world, why is it us as humans and not as lizards who are speaking right now? It was language that did it. It allowed us to partner. It allowed us to. And so I would say that the sort of obsession with writing, and I didn't know this, but the obsession with writing for 40 years ended up being a huge superpower in my life and very underutilized where I was. And because right now, of course, I now run a business that is entirely focused on writing in several different ways, you know, helping corporations and helping people write books and helping you know, people with their marketing and things. And so now I do that. But at the time, the business was a planning and engineering business. They were billing planning and engineering people. So even if you were a terrific writer, even if you were a terrific editor, it was still never going to be rewarded in that business. And so
it's not necessarily valued. Wouldn't you say that, Brian?
Yeah. It's not valued. I totally agree with that.
It's not valued. And they don't understand the skill to produce the result.
That's right. And
of it either. Okay.
So, well, I'll tell you a quick funny story for you now, but it's pretty recent where we falsely think right now that, and I'm getting more bold about this in my own marketing, but we falsely think right now that tools are outcomes. So we say Facebook ads is an outcome. YouTube is an outcome. LinkedIn is an outcome. Bullshit. None of them are outcomes. They're tools.
Okay.
And
they're tools.
They're tools. And so how do you drive outcome through that tool? It's going to be language. Guaranteed. Right. And then they say video is an outcome. Bullshit. It's going to be the language on your video.
You need some language in the video.
Right. So what's the thing that drives? And so what's happening? So culturally, people say, and I'm getting bold on this because we've been popular enough that I can turn down clients, and I'm happy about that. But culturally, people say, well, I got my Facebook guy. I got to pay him. I got to pay. So I can't really pay you that much. And it's like, well, good luck, because good luck, because at the end of the day, it's going to be your language, which is going to be showing the credibility and the authenticity of your approach to your business and why people want to do business with you, and not the tool itself. And so I think we vastly underestimated the importance of language in our culture. And I think that goes back to our education. The teachers don't understand it. No, very few people understand it. But when you have it, it's the superpower. And so I was in this middle at the organization where you know, we were doing good work.
At the engineering firm, where
mm-hmm. where we were doing good work, but we weren't. And I held on to that job, Mala, at least 5 years too long. And I have to think about why I did that. And I was thinking about that, doing a little meditation before we started here today. I was thinking about that, and what I've come up with, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, is the middle is driving an outcome. We just don't know what it is. And so if the middle is frustrating, I think we can probably look at that for most people and say that's a net good, because frustration is going to cause change on some level. It's going to cause change. So I think that frustration is kind of a net good. I think part of the problem is fear comes into the frustration. So then we say, I'm frustrated, but I can't change because of X, Y, or Z. And then we justify why we don't. So we extend these middles out. I did for years, extend these middles out.
So this is your example of being at the engineering firm, obviously being wildly successful in it, and then extending. So tell us what that really looked like. Was it, hey, my salary's amazing, or my clients are amazing, or like, what the hell would I do if I left right now?
Honestly, my salary was pretty good. It wasn't amazing, but I was there 16 years. So, I mean,
we'll go with pretty
we have investment properties. Let's put it that way. So we did fine. Right. But the salary at the end wasn't what was keeping me there. If you want the honest answer, we have a mutual friend, Holly, and some Holly-like people in my life, and we would all go for coffee. That's what kept me there for 5 years. The 3 o'clock
coffee break.
The 3 o'clock, dead serious. That was what kept me there for the extra 5 years.
So here you are. What did the coffee break give you?
This, right? This conversation, which is rare enough in the world that I think when you find this conversation, you don't want to give it up, or you're afraid that you know, I'm lucky enough to have found a position where I have this conversation 4 or 5 times a day now. But at the time I had it once per day, and not with 100 people, with like 3 or 4 people.
Wait, so how did you know that at some point you had to give up the coffee break, or you wanted to, because you didn't have to. So what did you do to, when you said, maybe this isn't enough, even though it's great?
You have to leave. You have to be willing to leave. And so I started creating my own business. And then I honestly got lucky here, Mala, if you want the honest answer.
Yeah, because I was just going to ask, you don't have an entrepreneurial background. You don't have entrepreneurialism in your family currency. But that's a bold move. So just walk us through what allowed your mind or your heart to say, I'm going to go for it.
Well, the slightly longer version is I paid for coaching. And for many years. So I probably dropped $50,000 into coaches, right? From the Tony Robbins world, from digital marketing people, And so access to information of people who looked at the world differently than I did. And over time, I became things that seemed, oh my God, I'd never do that then, I now do on a daily basis. When I first come across these things, it was, oh my God, I'll never have the guts or the balls to do that, or to put my own money at risk or whatever. Now, of course, it's pretty routine, but I had to warm up to it. And I probably had a good 5 years of warm up after the book didn't publish, before I left to get that going. So that helped. Number two, Frank, was I actually started the company about a year before I was advertising. And so because I was advertising, the phone was ringing enough that I knew I had a real business. And then honestly, it was very much a mutual, if not quite their decision for me to go. So I would have gone in January of that year, but I was actually out in October. And what had happened was they knew that I was running this business. And so they could essentially get the same thing out of me as a consultant. So we had, you know, a couple months worth of conversation about what a consulting agreement would look like. And we came to that agreement, and then I quit. And I quit, and I was literally back the next day as a consultant. Like, it
okay. Okay. So you were doing the side hustle, and you had gotten to a place where there was enough traction where you could feel comfortable pivoting to a contractual relationship versus a full-time relationship, which is a gift.
Now, I don't know, Mala, if anybody in your organization that would listen to this is any of your listeners are potential entrepreneurs. But here's what I'm going to say, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, and I wish someone had said it to me. So on October 1st that year, I was willing to work for half of my current salary. So that would have been, at that time, about $50,000, $60,000. I was willing to say, listen, if I only make $50,000, $60,000 this year, you know, we'll be fine. I've got other savings we've got, right? I'll build the business at that. By October 15th, I was like, okay, I think I need to get my full salary because of the market response. By October 30th, I was like, I'm going to double it. And I'm still sort of on track.
Because of listening to the market?
Because I hadn't really been committed until I was out.
Ah. Mm. Okay, so teach us about this. This is so fundamental. Entrepreneurs, like, listen up.
The obstacle in the road is the thing that makes you better. And so instead of saying, I don't know how to do that, let me take some time and, right, when you're out and it's really between you and eating, you're going to scale that thing like it's nothing. Like your world becomes faster. Your world becomes, you operate better once you're actually committed to it. And so the problem that you might have stared at for 2 weeks or a month or 6 months to say, oh, it's going to take me forever
or
to
years.
Solve, or years, solve that Facebook ads problem, solve that whatever, that you're going to solve that in a week. Because it's you will require it of yourself. And will you be up at 2 a.m.? Yes. But will you be up at 2 a.m. and do it? Yes. And then you'll have the knowledge and then you'll do it. And I think that's the thing I didn't understand, was that the tool of doing this business would make me a better person and a better business person.
Is it okay, Brian, to want a safety net?
Yeah, don't be stupid. Right. So absolutely want a safety net. But don't want to, but so have, meaning have something there to catch you if and when you fall, but don't have a security blanket. I think those are different things, right? So,
that's fair.
So absolutely know that if you, right, have plan B, C, and we can't be stupid, right? So know that if you had to tap your 401k, it's there for you. Know that if you had to, whatever, take more college classes or something. If you had to do that, you could do it. Like you could. So come up with plans B, C, and have them there so that you can feel secure in it. Absolutely. But don't cling to them, right? Don't not do what you're doing in order to do those other things.
Because the obstacle turns out as a gift. So tell us about the book, because I perceived this as a gift and a massive obstacle for you.
Okay. I'll give you the 30-second version. It was the book was about the painter, about the wife of the painter Amadeo Modigliani. I ended up with a very good agent. I would not choose that agent again. I'll say very reputable agent, but I would not choose that agent again. If I had to do it again, I already know people who I would say, can we go have a cup of coffee and talk about the book? And that's where we would start that conversation, not will you represent, none of that.
But back to the decision, just tying that back, the trust.
Yeah, exactly. So what we did was cut the book too much and then get it. It probably should have been about 350 pages. It took me forever to research this model. Like forever. I read everything about this guy that was printed in English for a decade. Everything.
Wow.
And it was amazing. Like so the story here is his girlfriend kills herself the day after he dies. They already have a baby and she's 9 months pregnant when she does it. And I was like, what is that about? Like, what is that all about?
Decisions.
Yeah. And so I was obsessed with this. And above me right now is a Modigliani nude. One of my favorite paintings in the world is hanging at the Met. I'm obsessed with this. But I'm obsessed with why human beings do what they do. That's really what I was learning for 16 years. So I couldn't get the book published for a couple of different reasons. One, it was too short. And what we heard at the time was probably one of the best written books we've seen all year, but literally People were looking at it the week that Donald Trump got elected. I don't want to offend anybody here. And what was happening, see, publishing is always working about 18 months ahead of itself, right? And so it takes that long to put a book together. So you're between 18 and 24 months before it comes out. And they were like, this is a dark book. Like, she kills herself while she's pregnant. Like, this is a dark book. Like, we don't know at the moment right now. Of course, human beings always respond to things that they see as negative. I'm not saying Trump is, but people, things that they see as negative. Yeah, we always respond positively. It's built into our DNA. But at the time it's happening, coronavirus, Trump, at the time it's happening, we think things are going to just be dark forever. And so that storyline was going through, and they were like, this story is too dark for this time. And so we never got it published, and my agent gave up on it. And so we never got it published, but I think it's a gem. I really did. It's sitting in my drawer. Like, we'll do something with it. We'll do something with it eventually. But talk about a middle that I extended way too much. Did I wait 16 years to jump on that because I wanted, because I stared at the ski jump too long? You bet. That should have been done. It probably should have been 8 years. Honestly, it probably should have been about eight. It was, if I had really committed to it, it should have been eight. But it was like 16 slow years, and I kind of missed the opportunity. I kind of think that another opportunity is going to come, but I kind of missed the opportunity. And great, right? So I have that story now to learn from. I have that experience now to learn from. So at a certain point, I would say I wouldn't even have an identity if I didn't publish that book. And now I look at it, despite 16 years and maybe being the most meaningful thing I've ever done in my life until I started running a business, I now look at it as a very small thing, right? Same way I might look at, I didn't get along with my parents. It's now a very small thing. That once we grab perspective on things, we can turn them into what they actually were. And those 16 years, strangely, both at that company and with the book, they end up being pretty small.
But we place so much meaning on them at the time. And middles can have that effect on us. They can absolutely thwart our perspective, narrow our lens, be it good or bad. But I love that you talked about, listen, I'll be honest with you, I'm obsessed with why human beings do what we do. I think I share that. I think our mutual friend Holly shares that. And when I had originally asked you the question, hey, Brian, what is the question? Are you on a journey that matters enough to you? What does that mean? I know we had talked about, well, you said, Mala, it's all about whether or not we have accepted the charge of being human. I love that answer so much, because I think your book story in the middle is such a beautiful demonstration of what it means to be human. And to shame it, we would, and the ego would love to do this, say 16 years, what a waste, right? And how old were you? And all these questions. And now you look back and the perspective is so different. Okay, so in our remaining time, let's talk about what your middles have taught you. Like, if you were going to give somebody advice around why middles are worth it, What have the lessons learned been for you?
Well, I would say listen to the frustration, because in all likelihood, if you're asking yourself, am I in the middle right now because whatever, the relationship feels dead, or the job feels dead, or the, you know, whatever, the kids are driving you crazy, or whatever it is, that if you're asking yourself that question, there's probably some frustration or tension that is making you ask that question, and that's fantastic. The question is then, don't ignore the answer. Right. It takes some guts to hear the answer.
And to be with it.
To be with it. And literally meditate on it and let it sit there and say, okay, the kids are driving me nuts. What am I going to do about that? And there are things that you can do and the things that you can't do. Some of them you have to accept and some of them that you can change. But when we justify it away, all we're doing is postponing until the next time, the next frustration. Then we postpone until the next time. We spoke earlier, Mala. My mom is 70 years old. And I don't think she has fundamentally changed since she was about 22. Like, it's just, she just keeps pushing off change. Right. And so it's the fact that we have people who are older in the world doesn't mean anything about they're more mature or anything like that. Like, time isn't going to give you wisdom, but new experiences are. and new ways of looking at things are and new observations are. And so I would listen to that middle. And you may have to keep going through hell for a little while in order to get the safety net, in order to, but I would start plotting it out. The middle is going to drive to an outcome if you drive it there. And so I would listen to it, and I wouldn't run from it, and I wouldn't justify it. And I wouldn't say, oh, that's just life. Like, your life can be wonderful and perfect and beautiful with the right perspective on it. But it's going to take some time to get that perspective, and that might take coaching, that might take therapy, that might take a new relationship, that might take a lot of things that are difficult. But I would go ahead and start that process of asking what those things are.
In the coaching world, we'd say you can be at effect of a middle, or you can be at cause for the middle. And you're saying, A, expect an obstacle. Like, if it's not shown up as an obstacle, I don't know what value would be coming your way. I'm simplifying that. You can disagree. And then number two, you're saying, do the work. Because if you are ready to do the work, all the gifts are waiting for you. But it's a proactive being at cause for the result that is guaranteed in any middle. There's a result, is what you're saying. There's an outcome.
Yes.
So you can drive it, or you can be, it can drive you. Yeah, because I remember you had said, we were chatting, you said, oh, Mala, the middle for me taught me that the future is my obligation. So wherever I am is my fault, and wherever I'm going is my fault. Or we could flip it and say my opportunity, however you want to, glasses half full, glass empty kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's entirely really cool. True.
And I love that you also, we talked about, and you shared a little bit on this podcast, because the book, The Coffee Breaks, that did provide tremendous value, but for 5 years too long. You know, you'd said, Mala, in times I've used my middles well, and in other times I've used them terribly. And that's okay. It's understanding or observing what occurred, right?
Well, I think so much of our lives are dictated by the narratives that we inherit. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like there's
kind of goes back to the currency.
Yeah. Like there's nothing wrong with that. There's, we can't get mad at our parents because they parented us, right? Like they had to. If they didn't say eat your vegetables, we'd all be dead, right? So like they had to. And so, but they did install narratives. And so at a certain point, if we're thoughtful enough, you begin to say, that narrative got me here, but I'm frustrated by that narrative. And now it's my obligation. I can't go to my parents who built their lives a certain way and say, how do you build the life that you've never even thought about? But I can ask that of myself, right? And that I think is a scary thing. And so I think we don't often ask it, right? Like I think we much prefer to drink beer and, you know, whatever. Smoke pot.
Yeah, have dinner on a Friday night.
Yeah, dinner.
Over
whatever.
And over and over.
Yeah, well, it's all right. I'm really frustrated by this situation at work or whatever, but I'll just, you know, have a glass of wine or a couple.
Yeah.
And you know, we'll get through it. And mostly by the time the weekend's over, I'll forget about it. And then I'll just be pissed off again on
Monday.
Then
we start over.
Yeah.
So using them terribly, you're saying you can, your parents are your parents, and you can come to an understanding of what their narrative is. And then the next step is, do you hold it on them? Do you blame them for it? Do you resist the reality of the narrative? Or do you go, that's that, I can own it, and I can change it?
And the other thing I would add to that, and this was something that was near and dear to me, so I don't know if someone else needs to hear this, was, so I had a great therapist, a therapist which was so good that I stopped seeing him so that my wife could see him, because he couldn't see her, if he was right, he was that good. After I'd worked with him for about 5 years and was mostly feeling pretty good about things. So, but this guy was great. So when I first got in there, he says, what do you want to hear? That your mother was like awful to you? Like, she was. Do you want, like, like, do you want to hear that it was unhelpful and that you're angry?
So this is starting well.
Yeah. And he's like, do you want to hear that she's angry? So, like, of course she was. She was terrible. She didn't deserve you. She was like, and he says, no, I can sit here for the next 6 months and continue to tell you that. But who do you think is suffering? Like, is she in the room? Is she
you
suffering?
Her.
Yeah. Who's suffering? It's not her. Like, she's sitting there in her own narrative, you know, pleased as punch. To a degree, and she's living with her own life choices, and that's good or bad for her, but she's certainly not living with how you look at her life. You're living with how you look at your life, and so whose responsibility is it to change that narrative or change? Same thing with jobs, same thing with money, same things with relationships. Same, like, whose responsibility is it to change the narrative? And at a certain point, you go, oh my God. That other person, you know, who cheated on me or whatever, that other person is not being bothered by this. I'm being bothered by this. And every time I think about it, I'm bothering myself. I'd like, it's
and
me.
You're carrying it around.
I'm carrying
That's
it around.
That's a lot of weight.
Yes.
So you're not freed up to become the greatness that, for me, I personally believe is in people from the moment they come out of the womb, kind of thing. Oh, it's such good stuff, Brian. It's such good stuff. Okay. What advice would you give someone who's trying to answer the question, am I on a journey that matters enough to me? And I remember what you told me in our original conversation, but I go for where you go now, and then we'll end with identity.
Okay. Well, thanks okay. for that. Thanks for that tip. I wasn't sure where to go.
Well, you told me... Do you want me to share what you said?
Yeah, tell me what I said.
Because this was the most unexpected answer I've ever heard.
Okay. You said, wow. I hope I impressed myself.
It took me 46 years to be comfortable with dying. And then you said, now I'm reasonably certain that I'm using my time well and that my time is running against my highest priorities.
That's a better answer than I would have given you now. That's a pretty mindful. Perfect. That's a pretty mindful answer. I do think that at the end of the day, I have one client who speaks about this a lot, and he's like, you know, it's not a mystery that if you want to know what your future looks like, what are you doing right now? Like, if you're working out, your future's healthy. If you're drinking a lot of beer, your future's unhealthy. If you're in a relationship that you're working on, the future's strong. If you're in a relationship that you're messing around on, future's not so strong. Like, it's pretty easy. It's a pretty easy equation to make. That where we put our time is where we put our time and our energy is where our lives go. Which it took me a long time to realize that my highest priorities have to get my time and not someone else's expectation of a job or et cetera. So of course I've aligned my business and my relationship and things to meet my highest priorities. But I certainly didn't do that when I was working at the environmental company. And so I think that's where I would go again, if I was really mindful mm-hmm. about it, is at the end of the day, all we really get is time, and we have to be able to prioritize that time. And that is going to take a healthy amount of self-reflection to know what those priorities are. And I think we don't talk about that enough in the world. We don't talk about it's hard for people to decide on their own priorities. Because first of all, Madison Avenue wants to tell you what they're buying. Buy this bathroom tile, you'll be enlightened. Like, that ever worked, right? But they tell you that. All right. Or your boyfriends, your girlfriends, your husbands, your kids, they're gonna tell you what their priorities are. But they're never gonna tell you your own. And so I think we don't ask enough what our own are, and then we end up in middles that are particularly drawn out in large part because we don't know the answer to that question.
And you're the only one who can provide the answer.
Correct.
Right.
So just in summary, I love this conversation so much, largely because I'm obsessed with middles. And the reason why is because I've never seen anything that when we invest time in the learning provides the outcome of intrinsic reward. And here's what I mean by that. Your 16 years with the book. And ironically, your 5 years of coffee breaks, it was such an education and generating so much data for you around your identity. And I don't mean identity ego. I mean identity from a spiritual sense of that word. I mean identity from soul, who you truly are, your nature. And I haven't, if you can crack the code on this, listeners or Brian, in terms of how to really get in touch with you and your soul without going through a middle, that's your $1 million prize. Because I'll give you $1 million. I found that middles are truly the only way to personally transform and actually see your own greatness. And your greatness, ironically, is terrifying because it's a lot to be with. And once you get used to middles, you start looking for them. So you're in your business and you'll stay up till 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. I know you're working on a new routine. I am too. But, you know, just to touch that, because the transformation's invaluable and it's this intrinsic reward that beats Madison Avenue, that beats the best engineering firm that you were at, and you were performing at a very high level, and you wouldn't go back. Even though, gosh, you had something to show on LinkedIn, and it looked really, really impressive. And as an entrepreneur, it's always interesting to explain what your business is, right? Oh, here's what I work. It's not a one business card answer. The engineering firm is. But the intrinsic and extrinsic, I ask people, would you trade the intrinsic reward for the extrinsic, which matters? I mean, the New York Times bestseller, right? The Academy Award. And 99% of the time, people say, absolutely not. I never trade it. And I don't know how else I would have gotten it, except through my own middle.
I think you're onto something meaningful there. The only thing I would add to it, the self is such an interesting thing. If you really sort of think about what we are, right? We're energy particles vibrating together in bodies. And so this idea that we have defined selves is something of a false idea. It's often something that we're clinging to, right? And to me, that's an indication of ego. So if someone were to say to
ego.
Me, yeah. So someone were to say to me, you know, what is it that you do? And I said, well, I'm a writer. It's true. But I could also say I'm a friend of Holly's, right? Like that, like I mean, there are 10,000 ways that I could identify. So when I choose,
both valid answers,
right? So when I choose one, what's making me choose it? In all likelihood, it's my ego. But in reality, we're just vibration coming in contact with other people, places, and things. And those people, places, and things are giving us opportunities to learn. So any answer other than that is probably indicative of where we want to be or how we want to be seen or something, and probably the beginning of our discomfort, not the beginning of how to solve the discomfort. So I would add that to the position in the middles. I think the middles point that out to us.
And it's whether or not we want to see it. And then once we see it, whether or not we want to be with it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Brian, thank you. Thank you so much.
This was so much fun.
I can't wait to talk again. I feel like the audience will want a conversation too. We can talk about that later because the ego is a whole podcast unto itself.
Yes. So, let's do it.
But we will talk very soon. Thank you, Brian. I'll let you go.
Thank you so much.